Listen, there's a great work to be done. As soon as you win this court battle, you must deliver this message. Take advantage of this opportunity and declare a powerful message to this world. He expects more of us. He believes we can do more. Who's going to stop Christ? Who's going to stop Christ from getting this work done?
This is Behind the Work.
Welcome to Behind the Work. I'm Grant Turgeon. We're broadcasting to you live this morning from the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus here in Edmond, Oklahoma. It was really a wonderful weekend. Got to spend time with my brother and a friend, and we went for a little trip. And now we're back, and we get to enjoy some more radio time today and just getting back into the routine of the work week, of course. The late theologian and educator Herbert W. Armstrong wrote a powerful book full of his life experience so that readers and followers of his work could understand exactly how God guided and directed his life for 93 years. And as we've talked about on this show in recent episodes, even from the very early days of Mr. Armstrong's life, God's hand was evident, educating him, giving him experiences and different types of jobs, interactions with people that prepared him for what he ended up doing later on in his life as the physical head of God's work. Today we're going to talk about chapters 6 and 7 of the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong. These two chapters have a lot of practical stories and tips for applying the 7 laws of success. That's a booklet, by the way, that's offered for free at thetrumpet.com. You can read it right there. You can get your own physical copy. And again, it has those 7 points that can really change our lives if we just apply them. That booklet goes far beyond just listing points. In fact, the autobiography expounds a lot on how Mr. Armstrong learned those 7 points. We probably won't just list them all off today because we'll talk about those points on a later show, I'm sure. But hopefully what we cover today can get you interested in those points. Mr. Armstrong here is talking about how he got into the advertising field and had a lot of different types of jobs involving sales. A lot of challenges along the way, a lot of funny stories, a lot of upsetting stories, a lot of pioneering type experiences too. He talks here at the beginning of chapter 6, which is titled Discovering Rules of Success, about a sales meeting that he heard about. And this man in charge of the company was trying to tell his salesman a new technique that he thought up. Basically, these salesmen would come and they'd tell their boss exactly why they were failing to make sales, what objections the people they were trying to sell to gave. So, for example, if one of the potential buyers said, "Well, I can't afford your product," well, then those salesmen were instructed to say, "Exactly. And that's the very reason you need my product." So I just thought this was a really funny psychological tool. And in some ways, Mr. Armstrong did end up using this later on. This is a way of sort of giving ground to the person who is on the other side, trying to come across as agreeable and as friendly as possible, but at the same time, trying to change their mind. That's not easy to do. Usually, people who make objections about God's truth or anything else like that often think that their minds are pretty well made up, and they definitely don't want to be changing what they're thinking. But if you say, "Well, I see where you're coming from, but here's some more points for you to think about," that's a really good way of approaching it. And of course, in general, we just don't want to be getting into lots of debates and arguments in the first place. But if something does come up, what about just taking the time to hear what that person has to say and then conceding a little bit of ground, and then providing your counter. It kind of reminds me of the grappling art of judo. It's similar to wrestling, but in judo, tiny 100-pound women can flip 400-pound men directly onto their backs, because as the man charges toward the woman, all of that weight, all of that momentum gets turned around, and it's used against him. There's no violence involved there. It's just basically being like the matador with the bull and bringing the bull down to the ground. But that's what you do. You kind of invite the other person in, and then you turn it around. I actually had an experience with this not too long ago when I was up in Buffalo, New York, where my dad's from, and I was talking to someone, one of my relatives, and he's actually a supporter of Bernie Sanders, the Democratic political presidential candidate. And I didn't want to talk about politics. I didn't want to get into a disagreement with him. But we were all there at dinner. I was sort of his captive audience. And he just wanted to tell me all about how climate change is the number one problem facing all of mankind, and that Bernie Sanders needs to get elected next because he's the only one who will address it the right way and come up with a real solution. So I actually listened for probably about 10 minutes straight as he told about this entire chain of events that would take place if the temperature changed by about 1 degree in the next decade. So obviously I was inviting him in. I didn't really agree with what he was saying, but I listened. I showed him that I valued his point of view. And then I responded, well, that really does sound like a realistic chain of events, you know, mountaintops melting and causing a gigantic avalanche and things like that, population displacement, all of these other effects. But I said, what about the start of that? How can you really prove that a 1 degree change in temperature is going to cause this entire chain of events to take place? Of course, that is really hard to prove, especially because scientists have been getting their climate disaster predictions wrong for the last 4 decades at least. And so I did end up probably winning, if you could call it that debate. But it did start with just sort of listening to what he had to say and then countering after that. And this is really a great sales technique, like Mr. Armstrong learned. When preaching God's truth, when trying to get God's message out there to as many people as possible, you're obviously going to come across a lot of people with different backgrounds, different experiences, different points of view, different beliefs, maybe radically different beliefs from your own beliefs. And you have to try to find a way to address their concerns in an article, in a TV program, in a radio program, whatever it might be. Address their concerns and then show where maybe their thinking needs to change a little bit. There is a lot of tact to that. Benjamin Franklin talked about how even if you're absolutely sure of a point, even if you know that your facts are right, you should generally try to avoid saying them too dogmatically, just because if you do say it too dogmatically, you're going to alienate the person who doesn't already agree with you. So that's something that it does take a while to learn, and it's something I'm still learning all the time. It can be tempting to just sort of strike out at people who disagree instead of calmly, humbly presenting your points. God's truth does have to be obviously pretty strong a lot of the time, and yet also there is some tact that can be used. There is a way to present it in somewhat of a pleasant manner where possible, just to draw people in. Mr. Armstrong also learned pretty early in life from his sales trips, from all these experiences, about trying to be around the most successful people you can, people of a higher class in life. He learned this from the Pullman cars visiting the washroom on these trains. And the men there weren't telling dirty stories. They weren't gossiping about their wives, as Mr. Armstrong pointed out. They were pretty much solving all the problems in the world just from having those conversations in passing in the washroom. It's interesting because last week in one of those Democratic presidential debates, one of the candidates said that when a bunch of men get together, we can tend to be morons. And so I just thought that was a funny statement. It's one that maybe in some cases can be true. I've had experiences where if a bunch of guys get together, certainly the quality of conversation or behavior downgrades. But I've also been in situations where the quality goes way up. For example, Spokesman Club. We have a Spokesman Club here on the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus. Actually, several of them, if you include the students and a couple different clubs for the congregation here. And there's a bunch of different clubs out in the field as well. At these clubs, we learn how to be godly leaders. And we put these leadership skills into practice through speaking and through a lot of listening. But it's not just a club of shooting the breeze or telling silly jokes. In fact, that's very little of what that club is about. It's really about learning how to speak for God. So you can see where in an environment like that, around men who have maybe those types of lofty goals, they wouldn't become morons around each other. But if you're surrounding yourself with people who maybe don't care about upholding a high standard, then that's when you could say that men become morons. So it really does depend on the caliber of person you're with. You can't expect to go into a room full of middle school baseball players, which was my experience, and try to get them to talk about a deep subject that is important in the grand scheme of things. However, you could talk to men at Spokesman Club about a deep subject. It really does depend on the person. The environment that you are in really will influence your standard too. You can't expect to single-handedly raise the standard if everyone around you is necessarily just doing their own thing. Sometimes you just have to avoid those situations altogether if possible. Mr. Armstrong also learned how so many people end up failing in their jobs. And sure, there are a number of different factors. A lot of it just comes down to not working hard enough or not persevering when times get tough. But there's also a mistake that you could make right at the very beginning. He talked here about the square peg in the round hole. Choosing a job that doesn't fit your aptitudes. We hear so much today about people chasing their passions. And sure, you might love a certain subject or a certain field. And yet, if you don't have those skills, why would you really want to get into that field? That wouldn't even really make sense. It's not good career advice to follow your passion. Rather, develop skills from a young age and then try to pursue a field that matches those skills. And then get passionate about that field. Develop that passion through action. Mr. Armstrong had a sad experience with a salesman who just couldn't seem to make a profit. He had done the math and figured he should be getting a 5% profit and yet just couldn't make the profit. He just barely broke even. And it really just came down to a simple mathematical error. Like Mr. Armstrong says, sometimes it's just simply a lack of proper education that causes people to fail. Whether that's math or just not taking the necessary courses or gaining the necessary experience for your field. Mr. Armstrong really set a great example of always trying to get educated in whatever type of job he was going to get into. He had a lot of help from his Uncle Frank, who was really an advertising guru. He just seemed like he had so much valuable advice to give Mr. Armstrong. But Mr. Armstrong also just did his own study. He read books and books on effective advertising technique. He wanted to perfect his craft, and he put in the time reading about it so that he could get really good at that job. That's how you want to get started, reading about it, being prepared before your first day of work. I love this story that he talks about here in chapter 6 about Ty Cobb, the baseball player for the Detroit Tigers. I'll leave that to you readers to go back and or you listeners to go back and read. But just interesting to see how he engaged in mental warfare there. Definitely poor sportsmanship, trying to agitate the other team so that his team could win. But mental warfare has always fascinated me. Different athletes, even soldiers in battle or generals, they try to do things to make the other side panic, to gain the upper hand. Whether that's making a bold prediction before a sporting contest, raising the stakes, raising the amount of pressure put on that athlete, and making the other side more emotional, more upset, so that they might abandon their tactics trying to defeat you. Or whether it's in war and fainting and faking, whereas the actual action is taking place in a different arena entirely. Mental warfare really can be half the key to victory sometimes. Ty Cobb was an interesting example of that. Certainly wouldn't advocate trash talking and verbally berating an opponent like he did. But it is interesting to see how you can affect people mentally in a situation where it's either you win or the other person wins. Mr. Armstrong had experience with trying to build a highway from Canada all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. And he had to convince every county along that route, or at least a couple of the counties along that route, probably not every single one of them for him personally, but he had to convince all the farmers, all the people who lived along this proposed highway route to agree to it. And he learned how to swing a crowd, how to change the minds of large groups of people all at once. He learned the technique of changing the minds of maybe one or two or three influential decision makers in the group, getting them on your side first, and then convincing them to support you in the meeting. Definitely an interesting tactic there. And he shows here in these two chapters that we're talking about today how it worked for him more than once. He would win over one or two or three people, and then they would help him win over everybody else. Mr. Armstrong talked about how people are so easily swayed emotionally. Emotion, that's another part of the mental warfare point I just made. You get the other side emotional, they abandon their reasoning, and they make uncharacteristic mistakes. But here, when you're trying to influence a large group of people, and a bunch of people just jump up and enthusiastically support you, that's going to make the rest of the group want to fit in. They're going to think, what am I missing? Why don't I already support this initiative? These guys are so excited right now. They must know something I don't. I should go along with what they're saying. I should also vote yes. Again, These are psychological tactics. You can see how Mr. Armstrong would be using these type of tactics in the work to great effect, to change minds, to win hearts. And yet he's learning all this in his early 20s. Chapter 7 here is titled, How to Put Resourcefulness into Practice. This is the fifth law of success, and I'll just put a link to the Seven Laws of Success booklet in the show notes once this show is converted into a podcast. But resourcefulness, this is a really difficult point to apply. It's not just a matter of putting your head down and working hard or reading books to be educated or whatever it might be. These other points, you either do them or you don't. Resourcefulness requires a really quick wit. You have to be able to make snap decisions in the heat of the moment a lot of the time. Resourcefulness is an extremely difficult point to apply out of that list. But Mr. Armstrong learned it from a lot of, again, very hard experience. And we'll get into that a little bit more as we go on here. He had this job at one point of selling memberships to this automobile club. And he was talking with a man who had $110 million. And every person who bought a membership in this club could also buy multiple memberships. Mr. Armstrong thought this man would buy thousands of memberships. Each membership was only $2. This man had $110 million, but he only wanted to buy one membership for just $2. Mr. Armstrong talks here about how he was totally let down. He felt like he had a cold bucket of water thrown right in his face from the letdown. But he learned that that's probably how the rich are rich. They don't just throw money away. It made sense for him to just buy the one automobile club membership. And so that's what he did. Just because you have a bunch of money doesn't mean you have to blow it. So that's probably a great financial lesson for any of us when we come across money for various reasons that we're not used to having. That's why so many people who win the lottery end up broke so quickly. Because they think, well, I'm rich now, and I might as well spend it. That's not necessarily the right way to look at it. Mr. Armstrong had a moment here where he was totally broke. He was in a town. He had already resigned from his job because he thought that his boss was about to fire him anyway, which turned out not to be true. He found out later. But here he is in this town. And he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't have any money. He obviously doesn't want to beg for money. He doesn't have a job, though. And he needs to get a job very quickly if he's going to be able to eat, if he's going to have a place to stay. It's interesting to look at a story like this when you think again about the end of Mr. Armstrong's life and how he's traveling the world on a church aircraft, and he's meeting with world leaders, and he had a nice home too, and he oversaw three lavish, beautiful college campuses. He got to experience later in life true opulence and splendor, the highest quality things imaginable. He wasn't particularly wealthy. He didn't necessarily have the highest salary, but God blessed him in huge ways for being a servant in the work. Mr. Armstrong knew what it was like to be at the bottom. He knew what it was like to struggle. And as later chapters of this autobiography point out, he went through decades of poverty, even as a husband and father, even as he had an entire family to support. He had to really struggle and strain to provide. But here Mr. Armstrong is broke in this town and he doesn't have a job. He just basically goes, hires himself a job. He had to think fast, and thankfully he thought of a good idea and he pitched this idea of writing a report that would help the merchants of the town learn where they could improve in their business. He did learn the hard way, though, that he charged only a tenth of what he should have. He charged $50 when he should have charged $500. So that's a lesson learned for Mr. Armstrong, of course. And he knew that you have to know what you're worth before you put a price out there. He talked about that. But he also talked about the cutthroat business practices of the world. The man he made that deal with knew full well that Mr. Armstrong should have charged a much higher rate. But he didn't offer to pay Mr. Armstrong more because of that. He agreed to a low price, really an unfairly low price, and he knew it was unfair, and he just paid what he agreed. And as Mr. Armstrong says here in Chapter 7, this world's way is based on selfishness, greed, competition, getting all you can, giving as little as possible, the profit principle. Our world-girding enterprises of today have been based on the giving, serving principle, and this way of doing things has built a major-sized organization that has been eminently successful, serving and benefiting millions worldwide. You can see the difference there. When God is at the head of a work, it's not about making as much money and as little as time, in as little time or as little effort as possible. It's about providing a value. This work, the message that we put out there, is free of charge. You don't have to pay to listen to this show right now, or to receive any of the magazines or literature, or to watch the show on TV. It's all delivered free of charge, at no cost or obligation to you, as the end of the Key of David television program always says. There's some other interesting stories here, of course. I'm not going to talk about all of them, but Mr. Armstrong really did have to learn about some of the evils of this world's way of doing business. And even back then, in his 20s, he saw how wrong some of these dishonest practices were, how different companies were sabotaging each other to steal business from each other. And he was disgusted by that. He was repulsed by that. You can see why God might think highly of Mr. Armstrong's mentality and want to use someone like that who truly did try to be honest, even before God called him. Mr. Armstrong wanted to work an honest day of work for an honest wage. He didn't want to try to get the better of somebody or cheat somebody out of what they deserved. That's why he was so blessed later on in his life, because his entire life's goal was not to be wealthy, was not to be living in luxury. God blessed him with a lot of that anyway. It just shows where the priorities have to be. Putting God first brings all of those material blessings too, as Matthew 6, verse 33 says. So today we've been talking about chapters 6 and 7 of the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong. Just a tremendous book, again. A lot of really great lessons here. And hopefully we can try to take these lessons and apply them, because they really will help us have a more enjoyable and fulfilling life. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Grant Turgeon. This has been Behind the Work.
You've been listening to Behind the Work. Email your thoughts to comments at kpcg.fm. Listen for a new episode each Monday at 11:30 a.m. Central Time.